I'm Donna Edwards. Thank you for joining us today. This is Woman to Woman, Let's Talk Leadership. As a woman of color and former member of Congress, I'm talking with women of color leaders at every level. What inspires them? What motivates them? What makes today's leaders lead? And currently, I'm a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and I am grateful for their support for the production of this series. You can find more about our work online at brennancenter.org. And we'll be posting our programs on iTunes, on YouTube, and on the multimedia section of the website. There's no way to miss us. So let's get started. Our hope is to inspire people of all backgrounds to take on leadership roles in their communities. And joining me in the studio today in Washington, D.C. is my good friend, a tremendous leader, Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who represents the 4th Congressional District in Wisconsin. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Congresswoman Moore. She was elected in 2004, the first African-American elected to Congress from the great state of Wisconsin. And in 2016, Congresswoman Moore was elected by her colleagues to serve in the leadership of the Congressional Black Caucus as caucus whip. A champion for women, Congresswoman Moore also served as the Democratic co-chair of the Congressional Women's Caucus from 2011 to 2013, focusing on issues surrounding health insurance reform, women's health and maternity, infant mortality, and of course, domestic violence. She was born in Racine, Wisconsin. Congresswoman Moore was raised in Milwaukee as the 8th of 9 children, and her father was a union factory worker, and her mother was a public school teacher. And after graduating high school, Congresswoman Moore started college at Marquette University, a single expectant mother on welfare. And she went on to become a member of the Wisconsin State Assembly and Senate before serving in Congress. Look, she tells me all the time she's the proud mother of 3 children and the grandmother of 3. Welcome to Let's Talk Leadership, Congresswoman Moore.
How are you, Donna? I mean, I was cracking up listening to your introduction about leadership. I was just thinking, boy, who knew I'd ever be a leader? I mean, I was dragged kicking and screaming into a leadership role. Just thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell me about that. What do you mean dragged kicking and screaming? Because, you know, they say that that's what happens with women, and particularly women of color. They don't choose themselves first, but they're dragged. Tell us about your experience.
Well, you know, I mean, as an African-American woman, you know, I was constantly reminded by everyone that I, you know, was nobody, that I couldn't do anything, that I had pipe dreams. Literally, one of my dearest friends, when I talked to her about my aspirations to go to college, she said, "How are you going to go? I mean, you don't play football. You know, you're not a. This is before Title IX. You're not a boy. You know, your parents don't have any money. That's just ridiculous." And of course, she never went on to college, and really didn't want me to be disappointed. I had relatives, you know. My Aunt Marguerite, who I went to live with my dad. I had a tough time with my mom. And so in eighth grade, I went to live with my dad's sister, and I was taking German. Milwaukee had the greatest number of Germans outside of Germany at one point. So everybody took German. And I went and I signed up for school and was taking German. And she said, "Well, why are you taking German? I mean, you're never going to need German. I want you to take cooking." And so I went to the school and had them conspire with me to type up a report card and substitute my grade for German and put cooking on there. And of course, it was the worst grades I ever got in any foreign language because I couldn't study at home. And of course, I couldn't cook either.
Wow. What did you learn from that? I mean, what made you persevere out of that? Because a lot of people would just get discouraged.
Well, I'll tell you, with regard to education, I had an aunt on my mother's side who had a PhD and was a teacher. And every year at on Labor Day, we'd get these huge boxes. My mom had 9 kids, and there'd be school supplies with everyone's name on it. And so I got my first compass, protractor in this box, didn't know what it was, graph paper with my name, Gwendolyn, on it. And so I came, and my mother was very brilliant. Even though at that point she got her bachelor's degree after we were all grown. But I grew up in a household where my mother would go to the grocery store and get the free encyclopedia if you buy $100 worth of groceries. We were in a household where we had no TV, nothing, but we had books. And I always loved learning. So I knew that I was intelligent. And so even though I got all these negative messages, I knew that that I had something special. But I was shy. People don't believe that. But there are still people who are alive.
Well, it's
who remember
actually
that.
Hard for me to believe
I know.
That.
People laugh when I say that. I was very shy. And I loved being in the back. I loved doing my thing and not getting any attention. And things changed in my life. I was in high school. And I was dragged kicking and screaming. To run for president of student council. Didn't want to do it. But people, my classmates said, hey, you could talk good. We want you to get up there in the front. One of my first demonstrations is that I was not eligible. I couldn't get lunch because I was my mom was on welfare at their time. And at that time, they called it a duplication of services for me to get free lunch, as well as my mom receiving welfare. So I lived over a mile and a half from school, so I couldn't walk home for lunch, and I had no lunch. And finally, in the 11th grade, I just got up, got in line, put all my food on my tray. I got tired of begging for food. I'd sit there and eat whatever people didn't like. I loved mock chicken day because nobody liked that and I could eat. And I stood in line, got my lunch, got to the front, told the lady very nicely that I was going to sit down and eat and I was going to come back and eat the next day too.
And what was her response?
Her response, she ran to the telephone and called presumably the office, and I sat there calmly and ate.
And what were they going to do after you'd already eaten it?
Right. I was sitting there eating. And at that point, I had a 4-point average. And I just decided that I was just not going to be hungry anymore.
Well, good for you. I mean, when I hear that story, Congresswoman, one of the things that I hear is also about what I know your priorities have been, both when you were in the Wisconsin legislature, but also in the Congress. And it's amazing how the stories of your life really helped shape your priorities in Congress.
They absolutely did, because I was a junior in high school at this point, a 4-point student, and I was hungry. I was doing my part to not only create opportunity for myself, my community, but to give something to the world. And people were treating me like I could be thrown away. I mean,
I was
a child.
Wanted was lunch.
That's right. I mean, I was in the custody of the school system, required by law to be there, happy to be there, and yet they were abusing me as a child by not feeding me. And so by that next year, I was in 12th grade, and there was a little locker room banter. The president always talks about the locker room banter. There was a locker room banter, and some of the guys, one of the guys who went to my church, told one of the guys, oh, you can't lay that egghead. And lo and behold, guy, athlete, handsome, I liked him. I had a crush on him. He invited me out for my birthday. It was my golden birthday, April 18th, and I was 18. And he invited me out and took me to his house and, we got to wait till my mom brings the car open. And, of course, he had to make good on his bet. You know, I stopped short of saying he raped me because I liked him. I didn't know at that time what it was, but I became pregnant, even though I protested, didn't want to have sex, and I was pregnant. I became pregnant.
And that was before the days of no means no.
Right. And it was also during a period of time when, and so I turned 18 that day, and I immediately ran to Planned Parenthood only to discover that I was pregnant, and abandoned, and left to be a single mother, and then treated like a throwaway person. I was 18. I went into labor. My daughter was born January 1st. So, you know, everybody was out partying. I lived in a household where there was no phone. I didn't have a dime. Phone booths cost a dime at that time. Didn't have a single dime to go to the payphone to call for a ride. Didn't have a car. I'm one of those people out there, Donna, that abuses the system. Because I called it when my neighbors came home at 4 a.m. I called an ambulance because I had no other way to get to the hospital, gave birth to a beautiful baby girl January 1st, 48 years ago.
Wow. I mean, I have to tell you, when I listen to you and I hear both the pain of an 18-year-old, but I also hear... you know, your strength. And I think about you sometimes on the floor. I've watched you on the floor of the House of Representatives. I've watched you fight for Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. I've watched you fight for sexual assault and domestic violence survivors. I've watched you fight for children to have food and health insurance.
Exactly.
And that, it seems to me, you know, if you're thinking about how your leadership progressed, it was through a lived experience.
It was absolutely through a lived experience. You know, Donna, I was at that point accepted at Radcliffe and didn't think I could go because I was pregnant and I had no way to fulfill that dream. I was also accepted at Marquette, but I said, oh, they'd never accept me. And Marquette literally sent people out to find me, to come to Marquette, and they supported me. Now, you know, my daughter was born January 1st, and I started in September. So I gave birth during the break. But the welfare department decided that they wanted to treat my tuition and book scholarship money as income, and literally forced me to choose between my daughter and going to school. And so my eldest sister, Jackie, God bless her, decided to go get a foster care license so that I could go to school. And she took my daughter in as a foster child. And the welfare department is sort of, in the mode of a Claudine movie, busted me in my pajamas at my sister's house and threatened to cut her off from the foster care benefit because I appeared to be living there.
And it seems like you're like the model person. You know, you have this thing happen to you. You give birth to your child and you're still continuing your education. It feels like the system ought to be supporting women like you.
I think that was one of the reasons that they changed AFDC to TANF. Now those women don't have that opportunity. When I was in the state Senate, of course, Wisconsin was the state that ended welfare as we know it, even before Bill Clinton did it here in the federal government. And the Wisconsin model, Wisconsin program became the model for the nation. And one of the centerpieces of that program was to deny women an educational opportunity. Why? Because lobbying groups like the Wisconsin Restaurant Association said that, you know, these women won't come and work for us. We have to compete against Medicaid benefits, healthcare benefits, compete against food stamp benefits, compete against a small monthly stipend. And we aren't willing to do that basic thing for people. And people are not stupid. They realize that they may be better off, you know, being on welfare. And if you let them go to school, here's this workforce that you know will settle for less than minimum wages, will settle for tip wages if we pull the safety net from underneath them.
Well, and that's exactly what was happening, and it was happening to you.
That's exactly, but I was able to, exactly, it was what was happening to me, but I was able to prevail and finish my college education. The day welfare reform passed in Wisconsin, 10,000 women, the first day of its implementation, 10,000 women across the state had to drop out of school. They had to drop out of college. They had to drop out of technical programs, vocational programs. And so literally since 1996, Donna, we have, what is that, 21 years? We have two generations of women who have become part of a permanent underclass because we have not allowed them to.
But not for their fault.
Not for their fault.
Not for their fault, but because the state has created what you describe as, you know, a system that allows for a permanent underclass workforce.
That's right.
To satisfy a lobbying interest that keeps them from receiving benefits.
Right. And so, you know, what we're told is that, well, you know, maybe, you know, you shouldn't have had children. Of course, it's easier to have a child than it is to get a sandwich, as I've just described. I mean, you know, who would think that you'd be pregnant the first time? But that's what happened. That's exactly what happened. And it changed, of course, the trajectory of my life. And so I attribute, you know, my training and upbringing as a Christian as transforming, but my educational opportunity indeed transformed my life. And so one of the reasons, the reason that I've come to Congress is because I want to fix this. This is absolutely sexist. So for all of the talk and discussion about creating equality of opportunity for women, you got to start by leveling the playing field with regard to their being able to get education and training. We have training programs, and they're, you know, these training programs are subject to criticism as to whether they're effective or not. But one thing about it is that most women, you know, cannot avail themselves of these training opportunities.
Well, and for things like, I remember my own experience, if you can't afford daycare, if you can't afford transportation, if you can't make sure that your children are safe while you work, or while you go to school, how do you take advantage of those opportunities?
Oh, you absolutely do not, Donna. And one of the provisions in the TANF bill says that they don't provide daycare for anything other than quote unquote work experience. So that you're there if you're, you know, raking up leaves in Central Park or, you know, or stringing beads together somewhere or working for an employer who's exploiting you and it, for your welfare benefits. No, you cannot have a real educational opportunity for even things as simple as, you know, cosmetology school or CNAs. Even those short training programs are programs that women have been denied because it, what does it do? It provides them with upward mobility.
So let's talk about your experience in Congress, because I know that you at a point you served on the budget committee.
Mm-hmm.
And people say that, you know, a budget is a reflection of your values. Tell me about your experience in trying to have your values reflected in the federal budget.
Well, I thank you for raising that. I was on the budget committee for almost 10 years for the entire time that now Speaker Paul Ryan was on the budget committee.
And he's your neighboring Wisconsin.
Absolutely. We share a border in Wisconsin. And let me tell you, so when people started complaining that we hadn't seen the tax bill, we don't know what's in it, I said, well, come and ask me. I can tell you exactly what's in it, because he didn't start this recently. These are his priorities. His priorities have always been to cut taxes for corporations. He's an Ayn Rand follower, requires all his staff to read that literature. He's always had this belief, even though there's absolutely no historic proof, that if you just give corporations a lower tax rate like we have now, 21%, that somehow it'll explode into this economic growth. It'll stimulate economic growth 3-4%. And of course, that has been disproved. We gave tax cuts under the Bush era, and what did we get? We got deficits. He's convinced that the real problem in this country are the entitlements. And he has said just recently that the next step is to cut into the entitlement programs.
Because you know Speaker Ryan, you share a border with him in Wisconsin. You served on the budget committee with him toe-to-toe. You understand where this tax, so-called tax reform, goes from here with a $1.5 trillion addition to the debt. And at some point in 2018 and beyond, that money has to be found someplace. Where do you think Speaker Ryan is going
to
find it?
Well, we don't have to guess. I mean, he has floated, just since we've been, he's floated turning Medicare into a voucher program, premium support, he calls it. They want to block grant Medicaid. And of course, when you think block grant, just think chopping block. And the only reason, and he's tried Social Security in the past, the only reason that they didn't make changes to Social Security in this tax bill is because it would have violated the Byrd Rule. But they want to change the cost of inflation, like to change CPI. I know that you were really big on stopping them changing the rate of increases in programs. But yes, they're coming after the entitlement programs, which also includes food stamps, or, you know, SNAP, formerly mm-hmm. called food stamps. Pell grants, I've heard Republicans on that budget committee wax on about how Pell grants are welfare. And so what they have done is they're trying to create the environment where the American people will accept the untruth that Social Security and Medicare, these bedrock programs of the Social Security Act, Medicaid, are welfare programs.
So
and
that
people are just gaming the system.
So what does that mean in terms of what you do in Congress, what you perceive your role is as a leader, and you know, and how you make an argument that you've got to take back to your state? I think it's always a challenge for leaders to, you know, talk about things at the 30,000-foot level in the Congress, but then to go and communicate what that means in real terms to their constituents.
Well, I tell you, you know, I have come to Congress, and I arrived 2005, and I asked to be on the Ways and Means Committee, because that's the jurisdiction where welfare, foster care, Medicare, Social Security,
all your priorities,
all of my priorities lie. And of course, you know how it goes. You have to be a certain type of person to be able to get on that committee. And I have fought to be on that committee and gone after it vigorously this last time. And I am campaigning now to be on that committee. I want to be in place. President Trump has said that his next adventure is going to be to, quote unquote, reform welfare. I don't know what that means, since it has a very small funding stream, but he's going to, you know, he has put this this narrative out there that here you've got three jobs and there's a person living next door to you who's on welfare living better than you. And so I want to be in place when that happens. And I think I can make a big impact being a person the only person on that committee, quite frankly, who's ever experienced welfare. You know, and to burst the narrative that these are just lazy, ne'er-do-well people. I was not a lazy, ne'er-do-well person.
And what you experienced on welfare was that that became a way that you could use a stepping stone to continue to get your education, to take care of your children, and so that they would do well. And so it has a ripple. I mean, you know, I think that's true. I mean, it has a ripple effect when you're able to support a family and then have that next generation do better.
That's absolutely correct. You know, I have two granddaughters now that have bachelor's degrees. And I have paid back taxes. I have paid a lot in taxes. I have repaid the taxpayers for every food stamp and chicken wing that my daughter and I have eaten. And I am so grateful to the taxpayers for making that investment in me. When you make investments in people, you do get the results. And that is why this tax bill is such a scam. We should be putting more money into educational opportunity. We should be putting more money into skills training so that and so that people can do infrastructure. That's what will stimulate the economy, not giving it to corporations who have already told us, Donna, they've been honest, we're going to do what our bylaws say. We're going to distribute them to our shareholders.
Yeah, I mean, it is really, I mean, the environment we're in is really frightening. And I know that you've been such a proponent of women's leadership. Why do you think women's leadership makes a difference in the Congress? I mean, Congress is still only, I think, 19.4% women. I don't know who the 0.4% woman is, but it's a challenging environment.
Donna, it really is. And I'll tell you, a lot of women are just like me. I mean, I was shy. I enjoyed being a kingmaker. I used to go to work every day and stay till midnight writing speeches for men, crunching numbers so that they could look good and sound good at the meeting. And I enjoyed that. I was dragged kicking and screaming out of the background. I remember working on people's campaigns. And my mom said to me, she said, you know, Glenn, you're as good as any of these people. You should run for the assembly. And I said to her, Mom, no, I'm never, ever, ever going to do that.
Well, you have to eat your words now, don't you?
Well, let me tell you, my mom died October 23rd, 1986. And in January 1988, which was what, like a little more than a year later, I had this dream that I was standing behind some podium talking, and there was this man standing next to me who was my state representative. And I woke up and I shared this dream with my daughter, and I said to her, my God, you know, my state representative is a progressive. He's somebody that I respect. I would never run against him. And guess what? I would never run for office. Fast forward. He called me up and said, I'm running for the state Senate. And if I'm going to vacate my seat, I want somebody to run who cares about the seat. He was a white man, had been a Jesuit priest. And I said, no. And I kept saying, no, no, no. Finally, he came to my office. I was working in Madison and said, Gwen, I really need you to do it. Well, I was working for a Republican appointee to the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. And he hauled me into his office and he said, Gwen, what were you doing talking to the former majority leader? We have a government relations department and you are not a part of it. You're not supposed to be talking to legislators. And I said to him, I said, oh, Rich, oh, no, no, no. I was not talking to him about WIDA business. He asked me to run for office, and I told him no. So that next day, he came back to my office, and my boss's executive assistant, also a Republican woman, brought him down to the cafeteria where I was, and he begged me, Gwen, please do it. At this point, there was an active campaign going on. There was someone who had been knocking on doors for 6 weeks. I said, no, 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 no. And this Republican woman said to me, Gwen, you got to do it. It's your destiny. And as soon as I said yes, I started projectile vomiting all over the cafeteria. The woman was dragging me into the bathroom and I was screaming to my deceased mother, leave me alone. I don't want to run. And I've been elected ever since then.
Well, there you go. Wow. I mean,
oh, no, that's the drag, kicking and screaming.
Well, so I just want to remind our listeners that this is the Brennan Center for Justice program, Let's Talk Leadership. And today we're talking with Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who represents her fellow citizens from the great state of Wisconsin. I'm Donna Edwards. You can follow the Brennan Center for Justice on Facebook, Twitter, and watch all our programs on YouTube and listen to our iTunes podcast. You can find us everywhere. Our reports and media are on our website at brennancenter.org. And I was just thinking, Gwen, as you were
You're cracking up. You can barely get that.
I was thinking as you were telling that story, you give a whole new meaning to being dragged, kicking, and screaming into elective office.
It is. And, you know, I remember when I first kind of outed myself as being a survivor of sexual assault. I mean, because I was not just sexually assaulted as a teenager and as a woman, but as a four-year-old, five-year-old. And I was sitting there on the floor listening to the debate about voucher schools. Of course, we're Milwaukee, Wisconsin is the first city, state in the nation to open up voucher schools. And we had a gentleman, if I can call him that, who opened up a voucher school, and he was a convicted pedophile. Hmm. And I was sitting there listening to people in the majority arguing for we had an amendment to try to prevent him from getting the payment, and he was being defended. And all of a sudden, he says, "Gwen, you have been a victim, but you cannot sit here. You cannot let this happen. You got to do something." And I was terrified and I was scared. And I kept hearing this voice inside my head, "Gwen, you're not that person anymore. You are not a victim. You have got to do something." And I almost got arrested that day. Me and another senator, Tim Carpenter, we turned out to be very good friends, and we were competitors in the Democratic primary to run for Congress. But I jumped up out of my chair during the vote and created a ruckus there over funding this pedophile. And he jumped up as well and got himself into trouble supporting me. So when you talk about leadership, I mean, leadership sort of comes out of necessity. It comes out of exigent circumstances. Nobody thinks that supporting welfare recipients is worthy, those people. Nobody wants to talk about the sexual predators, or they want to pretend that it doesn't exist. These are uncomfortable topics. And when you look to your left and you look to your right and there's nobody doing anything, even though you're comfortable not leading, you know, you can't continue to do it. You know, I jumped in that line in the cafeteria because, I mean, hunger drove me to standing up for myself for a change.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that in your history as, and I won't say a victim, but as a survivor.
Awesome.
How does that make you think about the current context of, you know, a president in the White House who has been accused of, by his own words, of mm-hmm. Sexual assault and harassment, of members of Congress who've been accused of the same things? How does it make you think about the current climate we're in?
Donna, I'll have to tell you, on one hand, it's a relief that we're having this conversation. But what I also see is that I do see, a lot of people who don't think it's a big deal. And as I indicated to you earlier on in this podcast, it changed my life. Mm-hmm. You know, this locker room talk that President Trump thinks is so harmless, locker room talk changed the trajectory of my life. And honest to God, if my daughter weren't so wonderful, it would have been a catastrophe. But she happens to be like a wonderful, wonderful person. And so by providence, I was given a reward for something that otherwise would have been so catastrophic. Because it is catastrophic for a lot of women to be forced into parenthood. Because parenthood, it's not a hobby, like Hobby Lobby
It's work.
You're right. It is work. It's dedication. You need to be all the way there. You don't need to be dragged, kicking and screaming into it. I remember when I was first, my experience has shaped me. When I first had a notion about the importance of reproductive freedom, I was 12 years old. So that would have made it, 1963, when there was no Roe v. Wade. There's a woman in my church who was pregnant with her 11th or 12th child, and she had a very bad heart. And I heard my mother on the phone gossiping with some of her church members and saying that they had offered her a therapeutic abortion. And she was saying, well, no, the Lord will provide and so on. And this woman died 6 weeks after giving birth. And orphaned 12 or 13 kids. And I asked myself, is this God's will? This couldn't be God's will. And that was prepubescent. It wasn't anything related to me personally. I just objectively thought.
And so that shapes then how you think about a woman's ability to control her own destiny and making decisions for herself, and also having resources that are available not just to wealthy women who can afford to go someplace and get their reproductive services and
exactly.
get an abortion.
I mean, she was a poor woman and had this opportunity. There were doctors who were looking out for her at a time when nobody could get an abortion in the United States. And they offered her this because it was clear to them that she could not carry this pregnancy and give birth successfully. And they happened to be correct. And so that was very instructive to me.
Even as a 12-year-old.
As a 12-year-old.
Yeah. And so and when you think about the Congress now, and you've been in Congress in the time in which, Congress made decisions that for poor women, that they would not have access to reproductive health care services because they were poor. And you've been there at a time when, in the debate around the Affordable Care Act and health care reform, there was an attempt to make sure that women could get services without regard to their income or their status. Things have really changed even in the time that you've been in Congress.
That's absolutely correct, Donna. And, there are a lot of people who could be persuaded differently if, in fact, they weren't such hypocrites. These are the same folk that support you as long as you're pregnant, and as soon as you crown, they abandon the baby. They don't want to provide WIC. They don't want to provide food stamps. They don't want the child. They didn't reauthorize the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is expired. And already people are being laid off. Programs are being closed down. Children are being denied services, And so what is the point? You're going to bring children into the world and guarantee that they are hungry, that they're poor, that they're ill, that they're uneducated. You're going to pillory their parents, typically their mothers, with insults and deny women to make the reproductive choices about the size of their family, when they're going to have children. It's so hypocritical.
So I want to ask you this because, there are policymakers who just kind of go by the book. It strikes me that part of the way that you think about policy is also about passion. It isn't just, can we create a new law to do X, Y, and Z, or what do I need to put my name on? But it's about passion. And I think that that's one of the things that attracts people to you, that makes other young women, and I've heard them say, I want to be like Gwen Moore.
Well, yeah, I'm on the Financial Services Committee under the leadership of Ranking Member Maxine Waters. And I have a passion about that. How could a person who was on welfare that cares about food stamps and welfare also be a person that gets excited about financial services? Well, I'll tell you why. I was poor, on welfare, gone to one of these high-priced, rent-to-own kind of places for a washer and dryer, something you need when you got three kids. Well, they waited. It was some usury rate for it. They waited until I was like one or two payments away from being done with it, a couple of days late, and they came in, talked my kids into letting them in the house and repossessed my washer and dryer. That made me mad enough to start a community development credit union from scratch and to be able to provide financial services without usury rates in our community. And I did that as a VISTA. So I'm passionate about...
You're entrepreneurial,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I'm passionate about financial services being a match for consumers, about our consumer financial protection agencies that the Republicans are trying to tear apart, an agency that's returned $13 billion to consumers who've been bilked out of their resources because of unsavory practices. I am so passionate about financial services because financial services really is a part of everybody's life, and it needs to be a system that is accountable and fair.
And so you were on the Financial Services Committee at the time of the Great Recession.
Oh, my God.
Where so many millions of families all across the country lost retirement benefits. They lost their homes, which were the core of their wealth. Talk to me about that time.
You know, I am so reluctant to talk about that time because I swear I got a free MBA sitting on that committee, and I fear someone's going to send me an invoice for it. Let me tell you, one of the things that I really came to realize is that 2007, 2008 literally mirrored those years leading up to the Great Depression, that where income inequality was greater than it had ever been in the history of our country in 1929 and also in 2007. That it really, there is something that looks like the San Francisco Bridge. It was Robert Reich, former labor secretary under Bill Clinton, that really, really talks about this in a really educational, important way. Income inequality that we see now is a cancerous on our economic ability to grow. Plato even saw that inequality was dangerous for a society, and we're there right now.
Well, and because it can't be sustained, where you have so many people who don't have, whose wages are flatlined, you can't have an economic system that lasts through that.
Duh.
No matter how many tax cuts you provide.
Duh. Listen, 70% of our economy is based on consuming. So you give all the money, this tax bill we passed today, 83% of the benefit goes to the top 1%. So here, the 1%, how many Rolex watches can they buy? How many pairs of jeans?
It's not the same thing as as going to the grocery store, buying your children's clothing, or getting a washer and dryer.
Right. Well, you need the masses of people to be able to do that. I mean, so after they've bought their one washer and dryer, what happens to the other millions of washers and dryers that nobody else can afford?
Well, you know, as you talk, what I hear you describe, I mean, on the one hand, you have the work that you've done on the social services sector, and it's not far removed, though, from the work that you do on financial services. There's a deep connection between those things. I mean, you're not a Johnny One Note.
That's
or
right.
A Johnetta One Note.
Oh, I hope that my colleagues realize that, and I'm placed on the Ways and Means Committee. This is a big sacrifice. I think people think of us, and Donna, I know you know, they think we're all rich, they think we're all privileged, and it's a sacrifice. You know, off the top of our paycheck becomes our living expenses for being here, our rent, a couple thousand dollars a month. What, this tax bill, the Senate, most of them being rich, they took that little $3,000 tax deduction, $3,000 a year tax deduction for living away from home, away from us. So we don't have 1 month's rent.
Well, and it's the kind of system, and I remember my service in Congress, that where there's a real disincentive for people who are ordinary workers who are, you know, in the financial circumstances of most Americans to be able to serve their country.
Exactly.
When it really depends on people who have the most extreme wealth. And frankly, in the House of Representatives, I mean, we see all the reports every year. There are a lot of millionaires in the House of Representatives, but that's not Gwen Moore.
That's definitely not Gwen Moore nor Donna Edwards, but we're moving toward a point where, you know, this body could just be constituted with millionaires. Both parties try to recruit self-funders, people who can pay millions of dollars to campaign. We have a Citizens United decision where all kinds of third parties, unaccountable, can get involved in your races. We're moving toward a point where you just may as well put, you know, the name of the corporation on the ballot. Instead of a person's name. And so, you know, somebody like me might become a dinosaur. I mean, and it's a sacrifice to get up and fly back and forth every week to be here in the minority. But I am here because I want some parity for women and children. I want to put them back in the equation. I want to shame the Republicans and the Democrats, because you remember, It was our former president, Bill Clinton, who cut the deal to end welfare as we know it. And it's real interesting. The chair of the subcommittee that deals with welfare just had a beautiful baby boy, 7 weeks old. It has opened his eyes to the cost of child care and to some of the issues relating to the struggles of parents. And you know, and that's the kind of epiphany I want to bring to the country. You know, so while you're walking around, you know, rubbing your rosary beads, you know, and going to your prayer meetings on every Thursday morning, that you are allowing innocent children to starve and be sick on your watch because of the greed that you have.
Well, so we're coming to the close, but I wanted to give you a chance to share with us. I mean, we have a lot of young women who are listening, aspiring leaders who are thinking about, you know, taking that turn the way that you did. What would you share with them about what it takes to be a leader?
Hey, you are enough, girl. You are enough. You have to stop listening to the lies. You know, really, if you were able to see me, you would see, you know, that I'm dark skinned and big lips, big nose, the kind of person everybody said was ugly. But you are who we need. When you think about Alabama, when you think about all the black women that elected Senator Doug Jones, that's you. That's you. When you wake up in the morning, I mean, who is it in the family that that keeps the family from dying of stomach illnesses and Ebola and so on? It's you. You're the person that's cleaning that refrigerator out. That's a skill set. Who was it that first discovered that pajamas could be combustible and would be set afire? It was women. I think about my colleague, Jan Schakowsky.
From Illinois.
From Illinois, congresswoman. She wasn't always a congresswoman. She was once just a woman in her community that collaborated with other women and said, you know, it's egregious that they don't put expiration dates on this meat. We don't know how old it is. And of course, she had to fight against industry, fight against everybody. And I think about her every time I go to the grocery store. Thank God for Jan Schakowsky, you know, who
got that expiration date
on the food, because that's important. You know, and so why shouldn't we sit at those seats? We're the person who tries to find a school district that has good schools in it and shops for that school district. Women are. Why shouldn't we sit on the school board?
Makes healthcare decisions.
That's right. We make the, we're the person that keeps you from dying because we know the difference between a little cold and when you got a fever that where you need some hospital care. We're the person who does that. And so why shouldn't we be on the health committee and be the head of the health committee? We are the people who are leading. And we're the people who are leading the Democratic Party right now. You go, girl.
Well, you know, I am really reminded very often that, you know, women wait so long before they tap themselves. They're waiting for somebody to tap them for leadership. And I think, if anything, the last couple of years have demonstrated that we should stop waiting. And yeah. That's particularly true for women of color, to stop waiting. And I would say I'm a Black woman, so I can talk about Black women. That's my experience. But, you know, it's time for us to step up. And so I just really appreciate Congresswoman Gwen Moore from the 4th Congressional District in Wisconsin for sharing your experience with us today, sharing your passion, sharing your leadership with us today. And look forward to continuing to see great things from you.
Hey, the struggle continues. Thank you so much, Dana.
Thank you.